From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on February 18th at a South Carolina high school. The bell rang for class change, and a teacher, 33-year-old Leanne Arthur, went out to perform her duties as a hallway monitor. She left her cell phone on her desk in her classroom. A 16-year-old male student noticed, and when Arthur left the room, he grabbed her phone. The phone was unlocked, the boy opened her photo gallery, and discovered nude images of his teacher. He used his own phone to take pictures of the nude images. It's not clear exactly what the student did with those photos, but we know that he showed them to some of his friends. The school says the student shared some of them via social media as well. Now, the teacher explained she had taken the nude photos of herself as a Valentine's Day gift for her husband, and she never intended for anyone else to see them. She said it was humiliating, and she resigned. The superintendent said she was at fault because she left her phone unlocked, and he hadn't decided if the student will face any discipline. But now some students are calling for Leanne Arthur to come back to work, saying she was a good teacher and a victim. And her case has sparked questions about whether the student broke the law by accessing someone else's photos without permission on their phone, and then by sharing those photos in various ways, including on social media. It's a whole new world of social media law that is still evolving. And this hour, we're going to talk about this case. We'll also look at other cases in the recent news involving social media, including the question of whether parody accounts are legal, whether Twitter can be sued for allowing religious extremists to organize and engage in dialogue, and more. Let me welcome our guests for the hour who always help us make sense of cases like these. In studio, we have Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and the law. Scott, nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Johansson's here, a senior lecturer of communications at RIT. Well, he's actually there. He's teaching today. He's taken some time out for us on the phone. Mike is not only a senior lecturer of communications at RIT, he's a social media consultant at Fixitology. And Mike, nice to have you as well.
Nice to be here.
Scott Maloof, when it comes to, let's start with this teacher in South Carolina. This is not a case that could have happened 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but here we are. And not only now can someone get in to see your private photos, they can instantly share them, and apparently that's what happened here. And the superintendent comes out and says, look, she should have had her phone locked at the very least. Mm-hmm. Is she at fault?
You know, Evan, like all these cases, the real challenge is we don't know all of the details of what has happened. You know, I reached out to some of the folks who I know who do education law, who consult with schools, and they said it's very unclear because some had said they'd heard that she had allowed students to routinely access her phone. Whereas I've seen other comments that talk about the student had said something to her, you know, after getting the phone, your day of reckoning is coming. So I put that down as it's not clear as to whether it was okay for the student to have the phone. And a lot of legal consequences come from that. The big three being, one, you know, was he allowed to take the phone? Two, was he allowed to look at the photos? And three, could he share those photos?
Okay. And, you know, this to me recalls some of the conversations that came up after a bit of a different kind of a case, but there are some similarities in which some female celebrities had their photo caches broken into and shared, and some of them had nude photos of themselves. I can think of Jennifer Lawrence, among others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mike Johansson, when that case happened with the celebrities, there was a lot of feedback online, people saying, well, serves them right for having nude photos of themselves on their phone. And it's amazing, I think, how often we saw that response. But then, of course, I think the logical pushback is, aren't we blaming the victim here? That is someone's private property. Where do you fall on that?
Well, I think at least in one of those celebrity cases, it was slightly different. I think it wasn't a phone that was accessed. I think it was a database, an online database that was hacked. And so the people might have had a different expectation of privacy. But the bottom line here is, you know, if you take naked pictures of yourself and you have them anywhere but on a piece of paper in a locked safe, and even that can be broken into. Look, the issue for me with the teacher is a bunch of things. One, apparently she did allow access to the phone. Another is she left those images on a phone. I mean, we all lose our phones at some point. We leave them around. And short of the case, the San Bernardino terrorist case and iPhones, a lot of phones can be broken into. So, you know, that's also another issue. But then there's also the bigger issue, I think, is people sharing this stuff on social media. And what I think is at some point we're going to get to be a culture where somebody shares something like that and so many people get angry about that. Why are you sharing this? that it actually stops. In other words, you sort of grow up a little bit on social media, and the response doesn't make it worthwhile for people to share them in the first place. And that's sort of where I hope we're headed, but we're not there yet, obviously.
Yeah, and picking up on what Mike had said, I agree with that. We don't want, you know, everything the teacher did was completely legal, you know, and it was within the bounds of her rights to do that. And so I think focusing on, yes, this was a poor decision, understandable, but that's not, to me, the central issue. We've got to move forward on that. And a good example being, you know, the student, no way she would have authorized the student to look at those photos. And double down, no way she would have authorized him to share. So the question for us is to say, this woman is a victim, you know, regardless of those other poor decisions, what's the appropriate response? And Avid, I want to mention this at the top of the hour, something called the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, which is out there. It's going to be referred to on the podcast link later. And if anyone wants more information, you know, tweet at me, tweet at Evan. Basically, they've got resources for men, women, anyone who's been in this position where images of them have leaked out. And there are resources to go to, you know, Twitter, Facebook, and say, please take these images down. And those associations will do that, as well as to de-index them from search engines. So when you do a Google search, they don't come up. So I think it's really important for folks who have been a victim of this, regardless of the circumstances, know there is assistance out there and things you can look to help resolve and move forward.
And you're saying that Twitter or whatever the site is will respond.
They will. There are tools in there. Now, again, it's an automated process. You're probably not going to get a human to intervene, but there are different levels of response for each of these sites, but there is a tool there for you to go to and say, hey, there are images out there. Let's go back to Scarlett Johansson. By the way, Mike, any relation?
Yeah. Most common name in Scandinavia, so unlikely.
That's where your accent's from.
Yes, I knew it.
But Scarlett Johansson's case, those images were taken from a cell phone, and she went out, and the first thing she did was she registered for a copyright and got copyright and said, I'm the owner of these images. Then she issued what is known as a Digital Millennium Copyright Act takedown notice to all the sites where those were appearing, and they took them down because there's a lot of respect and, you know, for that, and there's a process there for that. So that is really important to be aware of. Yes, whatever mistake happened, but think forward as to what process and what relief can be had.
I think that's helpful framing here, Mike, because, you know, look, let's take the teacher's case again in South Carolina. No doubt if she's leaving an unlocked phone on a desk and if she's had a history with students where occasionally she lets them use her phone, and if that's true, and I don't know that it's true, but if that's true, I don't know why that would be the setup or why you'd leave your phone laying out if you've got images like that. So again, we can agree there's bad decisions, but I think Scott is right in that we have to at least acknowledge she was victimized. Don't you think, Mike?
Oh, no, absolutely. And I don't mean to diminish that at all. You know, what I'm curious about is sort of what has happened since. You know, she has done a good job of being the victim, which, and I don't mean to make that sound like I'm knocking her, but she did resign. She wasn't fired. She did resign. And then she's been claiming that her invasion of privacy is being ignored, but that's not true. The 16-year-old is now being criminally prosecuted. So, you know, there are consequences for the student, and I feel bad for that student whose one moment of poor judgment is obviously going to get them in a heap of trouble. But yes, no, she definitely is the victim in all this, and that's the kind of thing I believe is going to become way more common until we get to that point where the actual sharing of people's private personal information is actually cause for outrage.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Scott, before I move to some other cases, just making sure I understand on his case, again, the school superintendent initially said, look, the teacher shouldn't have left the phone unlocked. And so she's at fault. And there was initially not a rush to even discipline the student. Mm-hmm. Now we're hearing that there could be criminal prosecution, et cetera. What is the difference if you're a student, if you're anybody who takes somebody's phone without permission, you access their photos, what's the difference between doing that and doing that and then sharing via social media?
Good question. All right. First off, for students and any parents out there, if you're listening, you know, definitely mention these issues to your students that there are huge repercussions, not only for the person whose images are being shared, but also for that student. First thing for students are school codes of conduct, you know, and what we see is that, you know, the younger the students are, it's much more informal. But certainly once you get to high school, most schools are going to have or would have a code of conduct. And that's the first place you're going to see, you know, discipline come in. Secondly, Evan, there's a related law to this, which is a state legislation legislator in California just proposed a law that said if students are sexting, which this wasn't, but this is somewhat adjacent, if they're sexting, they can be expelled. So regardless of the criminal process, it would be a parallel thing where the school would say, well, what happened? Is this, you know, sexting within the definition? You can be expelled. And then third, as to that thing, the phone itself, one, I'd say, yeah, definitely criminal charges for accessing a phone, you know, just
even if you don't share.
Even if you don't share, because of the fact we're looking at state computer laws. You know, New York's got them. Every state has them. So one is your state computer laws. I think New York's, if memory serves, it's something along the lines of, you know, accessing a computer. Then there are federal statutes. You know, one of them is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. May or may not be covered because this is a cell phone and you know, the cases have held. Yeah, even an old style, you know, flip phone is covered, but others have said, no, it's got to be connected to the internet. But there can be federal charges. The second part being those photos, accessing the photos themselves. Again, there may be charges because you're accessing a computer system. For example, maybe they're on the phone, they're on the phone's memory, but maybe they're Google Photos and you're going through the internet and accessing an account, which you didn't have. So that's another set of criminal and possible civil charges. And then finally, the sharing. And to me, the sharing is the big nut. And, you know, you're violating the terms of service of a lot of those services. For example, Facebook, Instagram, no nudity allowed, with some small exceptions. Versus, you know, that's one. And then secondly, again, some of those laws so that you could say, the teacher could say, yeah, I let them look at my phone, but I no way would have said you can dig in. And we don't know how long it took the student. If I were, you know, the attorney for the teacher, I'd say if we can show the student is digging around for 10 minutes, you know, it's a much more sympathetic case. If we can point to his revenge and his intent to inflict harm on her,
sure,
it's a much stronger case for her.
Okay. And so if we are ever victimized ourselves,
mm-hmm,
whoever, whatever the circumstances are, if someone is sharing something, let's just take Twitter, but wherever it is, someone gets an image of us, and it doesn't have to be, it could be any image that we don't want that was taken without permission and shared. These things move with incredible velocity online.
Mm-hmm.
So, Scott, remind us what you ought to do if you ever are the victim in a case like that.
Well, let's be clear. It depends on what the image is and who you are. You know, if you're Donald Trump and 50,000 people take a picture of you, it's going to be pretty hard for you to get that kind of image taken down. But for the average person, if it's an image with nudity or private personal image, you know, the colloquial term is revenge porn. There are tools to have that taken down by the sites. It's voluntary, as well as to have it delisted. Again, we referred to the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative. Go to that website. It'll be up on the podcast.
Yep.
And you can look at that. And there are forms there to have that stuff taken down. Another right is copyright. That's what Scarlett Johansson did. She got the copyright and she said, I own these images. Please take them down, regardless of who you are.
Get ready to get sued, and you don't want to mess with that. Mike Johansson, you're right, by the way, in that we do need to change certain parts of our culture. I wish we had a culture where the term revenge porn wasn't even a thing, Mike.
Yeah. But I think it's actually the first step. You know, the fact that there is a thing like that, I think, is slowly building revulsion in people.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's the first step to actually solving the problem.
Yeah, well said. Let me grab a quick phone call before we change subjects. Bud in Chilai. Go ahead, Bud.
Hi. Well, I got 2 points to make. One is, what difference does it make if it's a cell phone? What if she had left her camera there, which had no, way to release or just lock the images? And secondly, I wanted just to relate what the problem was years ago when Kodak, you did photo finishing. I was up in Building 65 where the main photo finishing lab was, and I went down one time and I saw some packages off to one side which were sealed up, and I asked what they were, and they said, well, those are compromising photos. And I said, what do you mean by that? And they said, well, they're people that were not clothed. And I said, well, what do they do with them? And they said, when they get those, they will not send them back to the retail place or wherever the person left off the film, but they would send a note back saying that they had held the photos and that these people had to call Kodak. Then, once they called Kodak would instruct them to write to them and give them identification, and then they could receive the package of the compromising photos. Kodak was very sensitive to that. In even earlier years, they wouldn't even process, they would destroy them, but at one point they decided, no, these are pictures that are owned by customers, so we have to give them the opportunity to get them.
Yeah, go ahead,
and,
Scott.
And just picking up on that, thanks for that comment, but there, you know, Kodak has been sensitive over the years, you know, even now in the age of Instagram and others, to the rights of photographers, to the rights of models, and understanding there is a broad continuum. You know, some people may say, you know, these are works of art in certain instances. Other instances, they're horrible, horrible images that people would never want released. And so you need context. You need to understand that in order to decide what's the appropriate way to handle them.
Here's a comment from Jake, who's listening. He says, a real-world comparison might be your next-door neighbor walks into your house when no one was home because you didn't lock the door, and then photocopies pictures you keep in your dresser. This seems like a good example of the cell phone being personal space, even if the law doesn't see it that way. Does the law, maybe the law does it see it
the
that
way. The law does see it that way. Riley v. California is a Supreme Court case where 9-0, I mean, and that's very rare, 9-0, they said that the state of California needed a search warrant to search an arrestee's cell phone. And we just had a case by the Ninth Circuit, I think it was decided yesterday, where the same thing, where an individual who was on parole, they came in and they searched his cell phone without permission to do that. And the court said, we're going to suppress this evidence. So the Supreme Court actually has recognized that right and recognized these things as huge digital file cabinets, no different than in the paper days of carrying around, you know, 300 or 400 boxes of paper.
And Jason writes to us on Twitter and says, here's a larger question. Are public employees forced to give up First Amendment rights on social media, even if using their own device on their own time?
That is a question way beyond the scope of what we're talking about today. But I think it's also, you know, it's going to be a realm of every context. You know, what we've seen are some cases where if you have an employee who is a public employee who has talked about an issue of really important public concern, you know, there have been cases where those rights have been protected, as opposed to an employee saying, I don't like the decision that has been made by this leader or that legislator, and those have not been protected. So again, it all depends on, is there a core First Amendment issue of how we run our society?
Social media and the law and recent cases. We're talking to Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and the law. If you want to find Scott online on his website or on Twitter, it's M-A-L-O-U-F. Mike Johansson's on the line with us. He's a senior lecturer of communications at RIT and a social media consultant as well. Now let's turn to a story that I've seen in a number of different news sites, which is suing Twitter over essentially allowing extremism or extremist rhetoric. And so let me just read the Reuters story, but there's probably a number of different sources that you guys have seen on this. Headline, Reuters, Alison Frankel writing, can Islamic State victim's widow win a suit against Twitter? And Reuters writes, if the widow of a U.S. government contractor killed in a 2015 Islamic State shooting in Amman, Jordan, wins her newly filed Anti-Terrorism Act suit against Twitter, there could be enormous consequences for social media sites here. What's going on here, Scott?
Well, I mean, first of all, this case grows out of the Anti-Terrorism Act. And the simplest way to say that is it's an act that does not allow anyone to provide support and assistance to terrorists. We've seen a few banks that have been sued under this and have settled cases or otherwise compromised because of the fact that they were in some way facilitating this. So the gist of the claim is you, Twitter, knew that Islamic State or similar institutions were misusing this site. You didn't do enough to stop it. And then those actions can be linked to the husband's death. You know, and so there's a lot of things to unpack in there. The level of knowledge of Twitter, who was doing the action, and did it actually link to the husband's death?
Yeah, obviously a tragedy. And Mike Johansson, I know you have expressed some, I think, a feeling that ultimately all social networks are going to be required to have longer terms and conditions at the very least to kind of protect themselves or at least lay out terms more clearly. What do you think, Mike?
Oh, absolutely. And you know how much we all love reading terms and conditions.
Sure.
So, you know, it'll be put you to sleep for a week and stuff at that point. But I also wonder, you know, and I'd be interested in Scott's take on this, you know, back in the day, were phone companies ever sued if it could be proven that a phone line was used to plan an attack where someone was killed? Or, you know, I'm thinking back, you know, in the roaring 20s and 30s, if mobsters used a telephone to arrange a hit on someone and that was a known thing, could the phone company have been sued back then?
And I think that's the, you know, Mike, you put your finger on the big challenge, which is These are subsets, subsets of people who are using the tools that we all utilize. And so when do we say we can clearly cut them off because they're genuine bad actors? You know, and the answer is it's very unclear. There's also a defense here, the Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which is a law that basically prohibits finding Twitter or Facebook or any website operator liable for third-party content. So, for example, if XXI has, you know, they've got comments enabled afterwards, you know, and people are putting horrible things up there, XXI is not responsible for those horrible third-party comments.
Mike, I think tied up in all of this are the questions on how you police it, right? Yeah. How does Twitter decide? I think my guess is, Mike, it would have to be a situation where the Twitter audience flags certain comments that they want Twitter to look at, then Twitter has to adjudicate on their own comment by comment or tweet by tweet. But I don't know where the line is. And I'm somebody who wants to see no militant organizing anywhere, obviously. Right. But at the same time, to Scott's point, how do you know when there is a legitimate bad actor versus sophomoric rhetoric? And I do have a kind of a basic concern about overreaching on deciding that a tweet could either needs to be taken down or is a criminal act, et cetera. What are your thoughts on that, Mike?
Yeah, well, so Twitter and all the other social networks do have a way of flagging content. But the way it works right now is, at least as I understand it, is a little clunky. So, for example, you can report an account on Twitter as being spam. You can block it. And I believe the way it works is that if enough people do that to an account, it rises to the level of getting attention at Twitter and action is taken. But that's talking about whole accounts, not necessarily individual tweets, individual conversations. Now, on Facebook, you can actually flag individual posts. So I think they're sort of working on this. But bear in mind, these companies are run by people who are still relatively young in the scheme of things in the world, who started out thinking that, hey, it's all kumbaya, the power of the crowd. People will point out the bad actors and we'll talk to them and they'll understand it. But it really doesn't, you know, these have become essential communication tools now, and there's just too many of them. So I'm not quite sure what social networks can do. I have a feeling, and maybe Scott can comment on this, that sooner or later, legally, they're going to be compelled to shut down. In fact, I know Twitter of its own did take down a few hundred accounts, I think within the last month, that were clearly linked to ISIL.
Well, I think I'm reticent to say they'll be compelled. And I think we look at the current FBI versus Apple as a good example of how incredibly difficult it is to compel. And I would just point to two issues that people need to keep in mind as they think about it. It is incredibly easy for people to sit here and for us to sit here and say, accounts should be shut down, tweets are violative, because we're humans, we can do that. But remember, I think Twitter's getting something along the lines of 500 million tweets a day, multiple languages. Some of those are in video, some of those are images. It is a Herculean challenge to go through and pinpoint what is violative, what is ISIS, what's a disgruntled teenager. And then secondly, you know, remember, there are plenty of non-US-based services, you know, example, Telegram, Telegraph, I should say, which are, you know, outside of the U.S. law and people can easily switch to. And so, you know, we can't have this discussion in a bubble and say, well, we're just going to do X, Y, Z. There are plenty of, as soon as we squeeze one place, things are going to go other places.
And Scott brought up Apple. I want to ask both of you to respond to a question that I think a number of our listeners have had as we've talked about that case in recent weeks. I know about 2 weeks ago, we had a guest, Tarek Fatah, who kind of made light of the fact that that anybody would want to say that Apple was right, that the U.S. government shouldn't have access to the data on the phones held by the San Bernardino terrorists, the husband and wife, because Tarek Fatah said, well, and he's an Islamic writer, but he said, look here, if you're on Apple's side, you would rather protect, you know, the social media commentary on what some idiot kid had for lunch as opposed to saying, yes, the U.S. government needs to know what terrorists were up to. And I thought that was so reductive as to be almost ridiculous that my own mind, I don't even really know where I've come down on this. I understand both sides of it. I am sensitive to anybody saying the government should compel this company to turn over this data because I am concerned about slippery slopes. And I'll start with you, Scott, and I want Mike to weigh in as well. You know, what are the concerns if we start handing over data to the government? If the government can say, in this circumstance, you must give this to us, are there slippery slope concerns?
Well, I think we always look at the statutes of, okay, you know, what exists currently. You know, the Stored Communications Act is a big one, which talks about, you know, where's your information stored in the cloud and when can the government turn it over, you know, and various other statutes. And I think the question is one of, you know, as long as those statutes are being followed, respected decisions and longstanding decisions are being followed, people have no problem with it. The question becomes is on these new territories. Apple is a good example. They have tried to say, we're going to be a really iPhone seller, and we're going to make the phones independent even of ourselves. And that's the real question. Apple being compelled to write software that will turn off the 10 guests, you know, software that would wipe the phone. I believe that's what's at the heart of the Apple versus FBI issue. And so that's where we have to be careful, because the second thing, again, let's take this into an international context. China, huge market for Apple. What if they come to Apple and say, hey, you want to continue to sell here? You've got to write this. You know, same issue with Russia and other states who do not have really strong court systems. So we have to be careful of that. Secondly, the comments about kids, you know, I find people love to draw the caricature of social media, of everyone, and make it so simple. But in reality, you spend enough time, you realize it's not simple. There are many, many users. What about, we're going to talk about parody accounts. What about the kid who parodies terrorism, you know, parodies ISIS by posting something that is so over the top and ridiculous? And he says no one would consider this support and endorsement of them. You know, yet you may have somebody who's reductive who says, well, one person does.
Yeah. Mike, Scott kind of analyzes the law, rarely takes a side just because his job is to analyze it and understanding if a case goes a certain way, what are the implications if it goes the other way. You weigh in once in a while. Have you weighed in on Apple, where you fall on that one?
Sure. I mean, it's a dilemma, and you obviously have to weigh the you know, it's the value of law enforcement being able to get into one phone, and I'm sorry, I don't buy the thing that they need to crack them all open. Against the rights for law enforcement to do their job. So I mean, in this case, I'm sort of leaning towards law enforcement, but I know that won't make me terribly popular with most people here at RIT, for example. But another issue that I would like to talk about a little bit is that you had mentioned courts, and Scott talks about Twitter can't be compelled, but we're talking about the United States. Now, look what happened to Google in Europe, where people wanted to be at the right to take things down, and the European court came out and said, you know what, Google, you want to keep operating here, you have to obey these requests to take stuff down, and that they got buried by tens of thousands of requests. So we're not really just talking about Twitter possibly being compelled in the United States. Maybe it'll happen through courts in Europe. Maybe there will be other avenues, if I were Apple right now, I'd be really concerned. You talk about China, but, you know, again, in Europe, Google's already lost at least one big case there. I could see Apple losing a similar case if law enforcement, Interpol, for example, really wanted to get into an iPhone.
Well, let's get a short break. We'll come back with Mike Johansson, Senior Lecturer of Communications at RIT, and Scott Maloof, a local attorney whose practice focuses on the intersection of social media and the law. And let's look at some other cases involving social media in the news. And as we talk about what's allowed online, what can you say on Twitter? We've been talking about, you know, should Twitter be shutting down tweets that look like they are terroristic or militant in nature? What about if you don't like somebody and you say, well, that guy is just a cocaine doer, as somebody did about James Woods. James Woods, the actor, who is very, very right-wing and very loud and proud right-wing on Twitter, and he's got people who don't like that. And interesting case about a well-known cocaine doer, James Woods, who I don't think is a cocaine doer. James, please don't sue me. But we're going to talk about whether you can tweet that, even, you know, do you have to clarify if you're being sarcastic? Can you do that? Is that slander? I guess it would be libel because it's published, right, Scott? Mm-hmm. So where does it fall in the libel laws? And then the question on parody accounts. There's a case with some local ties. There's a lot of parody accounts out there. Are they allowed? What are the courts saying about that? This and much more as we continue with Scott and Mike next. Coming up in our second hour, an annual tradition. If all of Rochester reads the same book. This year, Writers and Books chose Queen of the Fall, a memoir of girls and goddesses by Sonia Livingston. Livingston is a Rochester native. Her memoir is getting national buzz. You'll recognize many of the places and the people in the book. We're going to talk to the author about her memoir and the events coming up next hour.
Last year, 150,000 Afghans arrived in Germany. Germans want most of them returned to Afghanistan.
We have a huge number of Afghans who are not eligible to stay in Germany and should be sent back.
We'll meet some of the Afghans who have already returned home later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. James Woods is an actor. I don't even really remember what movie is it James Woods been in. Anybody remember on the panel? Scott, Mike? I actually don't remember.
He's one of those guys you see in a movie. Yes. Oh, who's that guy? Oh, that's James Woods.
Yeah, exactly. You've seen him in a bunch of things.
If my wife is listening, please send us the answer on Twitter.
She'll know, right? But he's a character actor you've seen in many, many things. And he is very proudly, very conservative. He is not friendly to people who are not conservative, I would say is fair to say online, and that's just his persona. He's a very strong personality on Twitter, and so he attracts some people who don't like him, and now he's filed this defamation suit. So let me read a little bit from this story, and our guest can tell us about this case, which frankly surprised me. Here it is. Reversing an earlier tentative ruling. Are rulings always tentative? That's a strange question.
That's a California thing.
Yeah. Okay. Reversing an early tentative ruling, the Los Angeles County Superior Court has ruled that a suit by actor James Woods against an anonymous Twitter foe can proceed. In the February 8th order, the judge denied a motion made by the defendant, John Doe, who writes on Twitter as Abe List, finding that the Twitter user's description of James Woods in a Twitter post as a, quote, cocaine addict, James Woods, could be viewed by a reader as a statement of fact to make people believe that James Woods is in fact a cocaine addict. And there could be some grounds for a defamation claim there. Scott Maloof, that surprised me. I thought people say terrible things on social media. I would never read a tweet like that and think, oh, yes, James Woods must be a cocaine. I don't know, but maybe I'm naive.
No, I agree. It's pretty surprising. But again, this is also at the very earliest stages of a case. You know, judges are reticent to throw a case out at early, early stages. You know, they want to let facts determine what really, really happened, as we talked about in the South Carolina case. But it is surprising, too, because we have generally seen judges apply a higher standard for online behavior than for offline behavior such as spoken or printed, just because they recognize, you know, the internet can be a pretty tough place. Secondly, Mr. Woods is absolutely a public figure.
Yep.
And so, you know, going on New York Times v. Sullivan, pretty old case back from the 60s, you know, he's going to have to show some actual malice by the speaker, most likely, to prove defamation, that the speaker recklessly, you know, said this, you know, but that may be the case if there's absolutely no history of you know, Woods doing cocaine or having issues.
Sure. Mike Johansson, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I, again, I'm not the lawyer here, but I do teach communication law at one point. Yeah, the actual malice thing is going to be really hard for them to actually prove, I believe. But the other part of this is, does it set a precedent? You know, in other words, can place like Twitter be compelled to reveal the identity of someone behind a pseudonym? And if they can be compelled, you know, at what level of offense what kind of offenses have to occur before they can be compelled to reveal the identity of someone behind an account? Because this could have impacts across all kinds of social media platforms that have anonymity at their core.
And we've seen some cases on that. We've seen a case out of New Jersey, a recent case from, I think it's Washington State. In the Washington State case, Twitter itself intervened and said there's a huge value to anonymous speech, and we should be allowed to protect it. I mean, the general standard is if you want Twitter or any of these services to de-anonymize a user, you've got to show a pretty good chance of success. You know, and Mr. Woods may still face that hurdle, you know. And then just on a practical note, I mean, you know, he's clearly well-resourced, but what are his damages? You know, one person tweeted this and he said some horrible things and has a history of it. Is there anyone out there whose opinion of James Woods has changed?
Has he lost work because of it? Has he lost endorsements?
Right.
Because I don't.
And you know, theoretically, I suppose this could be defamation per se, which means something was said about you that was so horrible that, you know, you're entitled to that because your reputation has been hurt. But again, in the era of TMZ, boy, I think that'd be pretty hard to trace that all the way through to a monetary damages.
But now let me think about the actual malice thing, which Scott and Mike get us thinking about not just logic, but also the law. And so here's what I think I'm curious about when it comes to actual malice. It's easy for me to say, well, this is kind of a ridiculous case. James Woods has taken a shot at a guy who called him a cocaine addict, probably hyperbolically because he doesn't like him. This seems silly. But now I'm trying to imagine. There's plenty of people who don't like me. That's fine. I'm trying to imagine. And by the way, we've all had trolls come after us on social media. It happens. It's not unusual. But let's say I'm trying to think in my own head here. What would I do if there was somebody on Twitter, anonymously, but persistently, not just one time, mm-hmm. but persistently saying, and not in a way that looked like obvious hyperbolics, tweeting things like, Evan Dawson is an XX. Pick whatever terrible thing that I am certainly not, a child molester, whatever it is. Evan Dawson is this. And every day. Would that be different, Scott?
You know, I think that to me rings more in harassment. I mean, you know, the first place you're looking at is you're looking at Twitter, you're looking at these platforms to assist you, and you're saying, here's the pattern of behavior. You know, take this user off, take this user down. And then secondly, you know, looking at it more of, because again, we'd have to show a reasonable person has, you know, believes something like this about you, or that you've lost work. I think to me that's a better claim, that, you know, some folks who may have hired you for something, to be an MC, to be a spokesperson, said, now I'm walking away from this. But again, that can be very, very hard to show and be expensive to show. You know, but a straight up harassment, you know, the emotional distress and the irritants that's causing you, that's a little more straightforward, and that's where we might reach to it. And that's when you get into the, we need to de-anonymize this because we need to find out who this person is and go after them. And that's where this becomes an issue. And again, this is why you're having these early assessments of, okay, is this a reasonable claim, or is just Evan suffering from hurt feelings?
And Mike Johansson, this is where I have my own internal push and pull when I think about anonymity online, because most of the time I find myself getting annoyed when somebody wants to wade into an actual substantive debate on any issue or wants to make strong claims, but they don't want to reveal who they are. Most of the time I find that annoying, and I sort of apply a little bit of a discount to it. But I think you and Scott have reminded us as well that, of course, there's value at times to anonymity. So I get, what do you think, Mike?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, for one obvious example is the case of a whistleblower. You know, someone's inside an organization and they're wanting to bring attention to something, and they decide that anonymity on social media is a good way to do it. I mean, that has value, I guess, to society or to at least to the people in the immediate surroundings. But you know, the thing with anonymity is, and again, I teach this in my social media class here, is that if you can't truly identify the person behind a comment, you know, how much stock and value do you put in that comment? You know, it's perhaps also a generational thing too. I would say that you know, people under 30 have sort of grown up in a world, in a sense, where anonymity is almost an expectation. People a little older have sort of come to this, you know, it sort of has happened to them, where more and more people around them who are able to comment on things are able to be anonymous. You know, there was a time you couldn't write a letter to the newspaper, old tech, analog, and just have it signed anonymous. You know, you had to put your name, you had to be willing to stand up for your opinions. But social media, of course, makes it very easy to be anonymous. And the real question in my mind is, you can be anonymous, but is it up to Twitter and Facebook to protect the anonymity if you're doing things that are truly causing harm? And then I would argue no. But again, that doesn't make me very popular, I guess.
and let me also get a couple of listener comments. Misty wants to know why did I describe James Woods as a staunch conservative? I never hear you use that regarding all the liberal celebrities. I will put it in more plain language. James Woods comes off as a jerk online. He is very rude to people, and he just happens to be very conservative. I'm just trying to describe his online persona. If he were liberal, I'd say he's a staunch liberal. I'm sure there are many staunch liberals who come off as jerks online. I'm sure there are plenty. But I'm just describing James Woods in helping people who understand if you haven't followed him. That's just his persona. He is aggressive. He's very strong. And he believes very strongly in his set of values, which is fine. I mean, a lot of people do. But he is very rude often. So do you want to weigh in there?
Yeah, I just want to weigh in on one more thing, which with the anonymity issue, which is also remember the flip side of the social stuff is greater investigative power. And I believe Ray Rice's case is a good example. I believe I've remembered Ray's name correctly, which is, you know, the video came out about what happened in the elevator. But the first video was the exterior of the elevator. We didn't see anything and we didn't quite know. And then a few weeks later, the interior
shots. That's right.
Shots.
The first video was him dragging his unconscious wife out of the elevator, but nobody saw what happened in the elevator until later.
Right. And the second part being when that second video came out, there was a very deep investigation by the facility where it happened of how did this video come out. Ultimately, it was shot with a cell phone, you know, from a computer and then transmitted by the employee to TMZ. And so remember, anonymity is valuable in the sense that the investigators went and they looked at what audio was playing on the TMZ video, what did the screen look like, what were the overheads from the casino. So if you're someone who is a whistleblower or you want to speak, you have to realize there's very deep investigative tools that can come out and come get you. People would triangulate a lot of issues. So, you know, there's another reason anonymity is so valuable.
Okay, and here's an email from Hector. Listening down in Hector in the Finger Lakes, Jill writes to us, "American need to remember that Nelson Mandela was, at one time, labeled by our government. Free speech must not be sacrificed to fear or, worse, to vengeance. Imagine how different our world would be if the current laws had forbade people from organizing to free Mandela." Scott?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, there's a reason the First Amendment is first. It's because it's the foundation of all those other things. I mean, people who say, you know, we shouldn't let this speech happen, we shouldn't let that speech happen, I'd say, you know, tomorrow when you get up, look in the mirror and think, if the government was telling you how you could speak and what you could speak about, how would that make you feel?
Mike Johansson?
Yeah, well, exactly. And, you know, what's the saying about bad things happen when good people don't react and don't respond? So, you know, in an ideal world, there would be no limitation. Anyone could operate a Twitter account, and there'd be more good people counteracting ISIL, ISIS on Twitter, so those messages would get buried. The unfortunate or the reality of the situation, which I believe is why Twitter took down some of those accounts, was that those accounts were operating to they were narrow casting to a fairly small group of people, and they were getting them highly engaged, giving them all kinds of inspirational messages to get them to come join the fight. So when you see that happening, it's, you know, it's not hate speech, but it's very targeted speech. It has at its core the purpose of recruiting people to do very bad things, presumably. And then it becomes a question of, is the greater good served by allowing that and hoping good will prevail, or cutting out that one, for want of a better term, that one little cancer on the social network?
All right, go ahead, Scott. Do you want to jump in real quick?
Just real quickly, just picking up on what Mike's saying. And that's the key, is a careful analysis of each situation and saying, when do we stop this? If you've got a really unruly mob and they're armed and they're saying, you know, terrible things, that may be a situation where speech is inappropriate. But if it's just a tweet, you know, online that people don't like, then we have to have a bit thicker skin.
Yeah, but see, now we could have a long debate now. You're saying it's just a tweet. You and I might agree to disagree on this, but just a tweet, if that tweet is going to 80 people who are following one account and 60 of those people are trying to get to Syria to join a fight, you know, that's a different situation, right? I mean, it may
absolutely
only be a tweet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, before we lose the hour here, and I'm either having a migraine or the clock in this room is malfunctioned, but I do think we've got about 7.5 minutes left here. And before we lose the hour, I do want to just talk about Twitter parody accounts. And there are, I think, Scott and Mike, I think there are varying degrees of these things, whereas, for example, I can think of some parody accounts that are obviously parody, the fake blah, blah, blah,
right,
the actual terms. Others that are not so obvious that look a lot like the person, maybe you actually use their picture. You might be using the same exact picture they're using in their own actual profile picture. You might not be letting people know it's fake, etc. Anyway, my understanding is there's even a local case that is at the center of some legal proceedings. What's going on, Scott?
Right. This is a case, Sims v. Monahan. It was here, grew out of Rochester. Basically, Sims was an inmate in Monroe County, and through his girlfriend, he created a parody Twitter account using the last name of one of the correctional officers, and the county brought a prosecution against him for this under New York State's identity theft. The prosecution ultimately did not move forward, and Sims turned around and brought a suit saying, listen, you know, you prosecuted me only to, you know, violate my First Amendment rights and to get me to shut this account down. And, you know, the question before the federal court was there a reasonable position, you know, to assume when you're the prosecutor that he was indeed stealing the identity of the guard? You know, and the court, the federal district court came down on the side of Monroe County and said, yes, there was it was reasonable to prosecute him here. But fans of parody Twitter accounts, and, you know, personally, I'm a fan of parody accounts, would say, boy, you're creating a really, really dangerous precedent there. And the example I would give is I believe it was in Illinois. You had a parody account, was very clearly a parody account of a small town mayor. The mayor was livid. And so he asked the police department to investigate. What kind of prosecution can we bring?
That's satire, though, isn't it?
That is satire.
If it's obviously parody satire, that's different than an impersonation.
But here's the thing, in that let's break them down. In the Midwestern case, clearly satire, but what happened? The investigator comes back and says, I can't find any charges. The mayor bowled through and they broke the door down. They stole, you know, they seized the individual's computers, you know, and they brought charges against him. So that is my concern, is that, you know, this case, again, it's very different. The, you know, the guard is sympathetic. It's very different. But that, you know, 2-3 years from now, you're going to see people, small town, you know, small bullies using identity theft and using these things to, you know, genuinely chill speech.
Well, which is probably why we should get out ahead of it and really set some terms and define some legal terms now, right?
Well, if
we don't need more authoritarianism.
No, we do not. No, but that's why we got to have these discussions and say, you know, what exactly happened and where is it? You know, the Sims case, you know, is very sympathetic. You know, you don't want inmates, you know, using these social accounts to harass guards, but at the same time, very, very much on the edge, because the inmates say, hey, look, I'm using this as a complete parody. No one would think I am the guard, to show some of what's going on in the jail. And parody's got a long history.
Okay, Mike Johansson.
Yeah, I was going to say, and as Scott well knows, there's a lot of law in this country based on quote-unquote community standards, and of course community standards vary greatly depending on your community, and I would say the same thing about parody and satire accounts. Yeah. You know, obviously, is it parody, is it satire? Would a reasonable person look at this and say, oh, this is clearly parody, this is clearly satire? But that's very subjective, and I don't know whether... I'm not sure where I come down on this, whether there should be a law that sort of spells out, you know, if 100 people look at it, this in Dubuque, Iowa, and decide it's parody, it's parody. You know, I don't know how you define, I don't know how, again, does it go back to community standards? I don't know. I think I know what parody and satire are when I see it. I don't know that I think you can legislate it.
And it's a moving target. I mean, yeah. You know, folks in their 20s who are using social media accounts regularly will have a different perspective than maybe folks who are, you know, much, much older and whose social media or other is either Facebook or the media taking those tweets and replaying them.
So it sounds like on this one, Scott, we can expect more lawsuits, especially in sort of smaller towns.
I think what you're going to see is cyberbullying, and you're going to see a lot of local ordinances about cyberbullying. Albany's got knocked down for the First Amendment issues.
Okay. About 90 seconds. I saved this last one to the end because I think we're going to have to spend a whole day on this, but it's a great subject. It's the right to Yelp law.
Right to Yelp.
That's how it's sort of known. And what we know is... customer reviews, consumer reviews, raters, you know, sort of, it's the democratization of the review. It's the deprofessionalization of reviews, whether it's restaurants, you know, books on Amazon, a million different things. And Scott, what's the law say now? What's the latest with this?
The gist of the right to Yelp, the law hasn't been passed, but their proposal, I believe it's in the Senate, is that you cannot, if you're a business, you can't forbid reviews.
And businesses try to do this, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. There was an apartment complex who put it right in the lease. There were businesses who put it on their website saying, you will not review, and if you do, we'll charge you. It was a New York hotel. Same thing where they charge $500 for a negative review.
Yeah, I love that a hotel saying you can stay here, you just can't review it. Hopefully it'll go
negatively.
One...
You can positively.
Oh, you can positively. Right, that's right. Yeah, I'm sure that's going to go.
I think Mike's got that in his classes, right, Mike?
Is that right?
Yeah.
Mike?
Well, but what I say to when I counsel businesses about negative reviews, for example, is the worst thing you want to do is take it down. The best thing to do is to respond the way you would as a human being. Somebody didn't like their ravioli. Apologize. Say that you feel bad for the experience. Please come see me, the manager, the next time you're here, and I'll ensure you have a much better experience. We never want an unhappy customer.
Yeah, and also for businesses, you know, have a process to have that speech in there so the customer feels they've got a way to talk to you, to speak, and they don't feel like I've got to go to Yelp and make my voice heard because this is my only way.
Yeah, we are going to spend a separate day on this just because it is such a broad field the way the democratization of the reviews has happened. And I know some business owners hate it. They think... people are armchair critics now, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, sometimes they carry too much weight. South Park had a field day with this one, if you saw that. But we'll come back. We'll talk more about what it means going forward. And I guess we'll still follow that legislation, because as Scott said, it's a bill, hasn't passed.
Right.
We'll see if the right to Yelp law does.
We'll see.
Scott Maloof online, scottmaloof.com.
That's right.
And on Twitter, it's Scott Maloof. And it's great to see you again. Thank you for sharing your legal expertise with us. It's always good to have you here. Thanks
for having me.
And Mike Johansson, I know you got to get back to class, my friend, but thanks for taking the time from RIT for popping into the conversation. And we will see you soon as well.
Absolutely.
All right. Short break. Much more connections. Straight ahead.